Good morning, everybody. Thanks for another chance to discuss maybe the actual Dharma, as near as we can get to it, with some precious human rebirths. We are precious human rebirths, are we? Are we awash in the ocean of suffering? This is what the great text tells us, isn't it? The Lam Rim Chemo, a great treatise on the stages of the path to enlightenment. We're awash in the ocean of suffering. It's hard to think of it like that sometimes, isn't it? But with this global warming business and, you know, human population explosion, maybe it's getting a bit easier to think like that. Anyway, we have some spark of intelligence. So let's use it on the Dharma teaching. Might turn out to be something really special, this Dharma, you know? Complete recipe for getting from here to enlightenment. Radek. Another precious human rebirth. So we have to, I suggest we do some meditation first of all, because every time we try to leave it to the end of the session, it seems to get squeezed out. So I think we should start off today. First session till 11:15, as yesterday. So let's do a bit of refuge. So we say the refuge prayer, mandala. So that'd be page 20. We want the mandala as well, so maybe we should go to page 20, because they're both, so on the next page we've got mandala offering, yeah? Then I want to, we'll do this, the chant that reminds us of the points of the first two seals. There you are, Radek. That one's new. The other one you should have got already. But take whatever you
need.
Yeah. So we'll do a bit of meditation on impermanence, such as we've been, you know, that's more sort of a subtle, tricky subject, so we need plenty of thought about that one. And then some meditation on the suffering of the lower realms this time. So we're not really connecting impermanence and suffering, which is what Ganla Rinpoche is trying to do, so we'll be coming to that. But in this meditation, just half the time we'll spend meditating on impermanence first, and then meditation on the lower realms. Yesterday we did meditations on suffering, but it was like more like the generalized sufferings of, you know, samsara. But there is a section in the Lam Rim Chemo, the great treatise, where you're concentrating just on the suffering of the lower realms. So we'll try to think, you know, try to take that on board and sort of see what effect that has on our practice. Okay then, so let's do that first. Few minutes of breathing meditation then. So that's just calming the mind, letting distractions subside, just letting our body and mind sort of settle together. So the energies of the body are not interfering with the mind, but are sort of harmonized, muscles relaxed, senses sort of turned off, drawn inwards. Just first of all concentrating on the in and out of the breath at the nostrils. So breathe deeply from the abdomen, just to make sure that you are just fully relaxed, as much as possible. So now let's say the Refuge and Bodhicitta prayer. Sangye Chödan Sogi Chognam La Janchu Bodhu Dagni Kapsuchi Dagi Cheshe Gipe Sonam Ki Drola Pentya Sangye Drupa Shog Sangye Chödan Sogi Chognam La Janchu Badu Dagni Kapsuchi, Dagi Chunye Gipe Sonam Ki, Drola Penche Sangye Drupa Shog, Sangye Chedan Sogi Chonam La, Janchu Badu Dagni Kapsuchi, Dagi Chunye Gipe Sonam Ki, Drola Penche Sangye Drupa Shog. So let's just think just a couple of minutes on the three jewels of refuge and our motive for going for refuge, the fear of the sufferings of cyclic existence, and our longing for, you know, to internalize the teachings of the Buddha as to how to be free from those sufferings. So, taking Buddha as our guide and his teachings as our instructions, then the best thing to do is to generate a motivation that includes all other sentient beings. So that's we're really going to strive for, the highest knowledge, the highest state of being, just so that we can, above all, be helpful to others. All others are suffering just like me, so let me help them. And averse to contemplate or just to remind us of some part of this motivation. As no one wants the slightest suffering, nor ever has enough of happiness, myself and others, there's no difference. Bless me to be the cause of others' joy. So along with our aspirations, along with our request of the Buddha for blessings, inspiration, then we are quite appropriate to make an offering, to offer up to the Buddhas the whole universe visualized in a very splendid and pure form. So this is the mandala offering. So brief mandala offering, page 22. Saje Paki Chukshin Mato Cham Rirab Benji Nida Yampadi Sangye Jingdu Mekte Uwagi Chokuna Guru Ratna Mandala Kam Niriyatayami. So the Buddhas are even more delighted than usual with our requests and our aspirations and offerings. So their inspiration, their influence, their blessings, the power of their wisdom and understanding rubs off on us. It comes to us in the form of pure light, which purifies our hindrances, our obstacles, our negative karma, and then that's a white light, and then with a golden light, it ripens up our good potentials, makes our good karma ripen so that we are able to understand the teachings easily and quickly. So the condensed version of what we are trying to understand in the first two seals, at least my attempt to make it the condensed version, is in the verses, a chant derived from Genla Rinpa's first two seals. So let's just chant that one, so then we can think about the meaning of those words as our basis. Sound is impermanent because produced, as is the final moment of a flame. Produced right then, it must disintegrate, for all effects in this are just the same. If flame produced the fuel, its course has ceased. These two events are simultaneous. But when fuel ceases, so must its effect. If no more fuel, then no more flame, of course. But a lamp's last moment gleams and dies. Fuel ends in flame without an interval. Between fuel's end and flames, though here there is a moment, time infinitesimal. So merely from its causes ceasing then, immediately it must also cease. No other cause required impermanence. Reflecting thus, seek out the road to peace. When life runs through the fingers like dry sand, all worldly hopes and fears the plans we lay, sandcastles circled by the lapping tide, birth, aging, sickness, death, what more to say? The glories of this world disfigured by its causal flaw, the worm within the bud, quads flung by karma from affliction sprung, bring suffering assured, no lasting good. Not just that death is certain, even now, remorseless degradation towards death, impermanence of gross and subtle kinds, sheer instability in every breath, continuum of similar type or not, from gross the suffering of change we know, from subtle compositional suffering, so let revulsion for samsara go. Impermanence dissolve all fantasies of this life's comfort, wealth, prowess or power. Let me determine to forsake the world, with focused effort fill the fleeting hour. So first of all, a little meditation on impermanence then. So let's try to use the reasoning, that's the classic reasoning, that's come down to us from the great masters. So this is the reasoning. Considering the subject sound, it is impermanent because it's produced, because it's a product, just like the final moment of a flame. So our primary subject, sound, then, first of all, we can consider, is the reason established upon the subject? So is it fair to say that sound is produced from causes? So you don't have to take sound in general. You can take some particular sound to be thinking about. But just remind ourselves, you know, that this feature of existence, that, you know, it's always causes accumulating, not just one cause, but many accumulating together, piling together, you know, assembling and then interacting, produces any effect. So all the things of this world are all produced like that. They're all compounded out of a, you know, perhaps even an infinite number of causes. So that's how they come to be. So if any particular thing, like the sound of a trumpet or whatever, sound of guitar, we can see that we can easily understand. And the last moment of the Buttalam too, of course. We should be confident or, you know, ascertain that that's also arising from its own collection of causes. Then we have to look at the pervasion. If it is produced from causes, is it necessarily impermanent? Definition of impermanent is momentary. momentarily disintegrating, momentarily transforming. And the kind of impermanence we are trying to understand is subtle, you know, the very most subtle. So right from the very point of production, it's in that disintegrating mode, it's in that transforming mode. So if it's produced from causes and conditions, is it really helpless to be anything else but just completely transient? So you have to look at the last mode of the butter lamp and then see how this sort of a transience of our produced thing is certainly, you know, it's clearer there than anywhere else perhaps. That last drop of fuel comes within the heat zone and it ignites. So, you know, the flame that's already there is like, you know, a condition for the last moment of flame. But the substantial cause of the last moment of flame is that last moment of fuel. You know, the flame that's already there is like, you know, the cooperative condition. It helps the flame, you know, it helps the last moment of fuel to become flame by providing the heat. You know, the heat and the oxygen and the fuel, you see. But what becomes the last moment of flame is just that last drop of fuel. But you can see immediately that when the fuel's used up, as soon as the fuel's used up, then there's no more cause, no more fuel, no more flame. So it just goes into darkness. Cause and effect are sequential. So for the effect to arise, the cause has to cease, yeah? The cause ceases, the effect arises. So those two are simultaneous. But we say as soon as the cause ceases, you know, when there's no more fuel, then you won't have any more flame. So the flame from that fuel is just, it kind of immediately goes out, doesn't it? It lasts for just this infinitesimally short time. No more fuel, no more flame. So how long does it take for the flame to go out after the fuel is finished? It just has its little brief life. And even in that brief moment of time, the flame is not static at all. It's just producing and going out. So the flame doesn't need any more cause, any other cause to make it go out. It doesn't have to be, you know, it doesn't have to have any wind or anything water dropped on it to make it go out. It's produced in a disintegrating mode. It's produced such that it immediately on having been produced, it goes out, it ceases. So that subtle impermanence, not requiring any other conditions or circumstances, just the mere fact of being produced means it's destined for destruction. Now, what's very obvious for the last moment of flame, because you know you just go from light to darkness, is equally true for all the previous moments of flame, isn't it? They're just the same. It's like one little, you know, moment of flame produced from one little drop of fuel. Every little moment of flame is produced from a new little, another drop of fuel coming up the wick. So it cannot be, but just entirely momentary phenomena. New flame is produced in every, wherever you look, wherever you point at the flame in time, you always say, look, a new flame is just arising. A new flame has just arisen. So it's new wherever you point at the time, at the continuum. So no continuum of similar type for the flame. That the fuel becomes flame, the flame goes into what, smoke or something, dissipates its heat into the atmosphere. So there's no substantial cause producing a substantial effect similar to itself. So that's why they say it's a good thing to look at. One moment of human being, it looks very, very much like the next. One moment of pot looks very like the next. But the flame is different. The flame changes into, the fuel changes into flame immediately. And the flame can't last at all. It immediately goes out. It immediately uses up the fuel and then passes away into something else. So this is a no continuum of similar type, so therefore it's kind of easier to spot this impermanence, process, continual transformation. So is it the same for all caused things? Is it the same for all products? It's not just a question of making the thing in the beginning, and then for however long it lasts, it just stays the same until it's destroyed. But isn't it the case if everything is, in every moment it arises from a set of causes and conditions? Not just it arises at the beginning and then it's established, and once established it's just, static or something. Just like the flame, every moment it gets produced anew. A new set of causes. So then sheer impermanence. So now let's transfer our attention to sound then. So that was realizing it on the last moment of the flame. You're realizing impermanence, but it's not so subtle. It's something that we can sort of see with our eyes, you know, it's like ascertain through thinking about what we're seeing. Subtle impermanence, and actually no subtle impermanence. On other phenomena, it becomes a question of it's not obvious to our eyes. It's like something we have to delve into with our thinking and say, yes, all phenomena must be like that last moment of the flame. And an easier one is sound, because again, you can see when you think about it, every moment of sound is produced anew from a new set of causes. Not like one moment of sound produces the next moment of sound. If you want the sound to last for 3 seconds, you know, you have to make the sound last 3 seconds. You have to breathe out for 3 seconds and make your vocal cords vibrate for 3 seconds. So every moment of sound's coming out of your throat, for instance, you know, you have to keep exhaling the breath. To make the sound, each moment of sound has to be made newly. So then you can't escape the fact that it's impermanent. So finally, let's turn our attention to ourselves. Aren't we just exactly like that? It seems like, you know, I'm the person here today, the same as the person who was here yesterday. The person who went to bed at night is the same as the person who got up in the morning. But there's no such solidity, there's no such kind of, you know, persistence without change whatsoever, or anything that's created from causes. There's a constant falling away from what you are, constant passing away into something new. And all the objects of our attachment or of our annoyance, our anger, they're just the same. They're also just falling away, passing away. It's briefly here, unable to maintain, continually transforming. Even this body that seems to be such a dominant part of who we are, it's just like a costume that an actor puts on for a show and then discards at the end of the performance. body dies, but the mind goes on. Then taking the long view, thinking about where else we could end up in cyclic existence. And then, as I said, it's also recommended we meditate on those other places that we could end up in. Just depends upon the state of our mind at death, what's ripening up there, what catches us, you know, where does that attachment lead us, and a ripening up and negative actions. Process by that time we have very little control over. So at that time it's like, you know, karma and affliction are in the driving seat. Universe has, the whole spectrum of a huge variety of rebirths, from the most sort of suffering and acute and agonizing to, you know, those realms of serenity, peace, beyond perhaps even having a physical body at all. Those rebirths still in samsara, but, you know, far away from the excitement and the sorrows of desire realm, where you're just absorbed in meditative concentration, the eons. But here we're meditating on the suffering of the lower realms. So, the medieval mind or the ancient Indian mind, I think these descriptions come from Asanga, who's, 6th century AD or something. But we can easily dress them up in any modern form we like, and we can imagine just still being a human but going through similar types of suffering. Wherever our karma blows us, just a leaf in the wind of our karma. So, some descriptions of hell realms. So, when the living beings in the crushing hell gather and congregate, the hell guardians herd them all between two iron mountains shaped like goats' heads, and then squeeze them between the mountains, causing streams of blood to gush forth from all their orifices. They are also pressed between sheep-headed, horse-headed, elephant-headed, lion-headed, and tiger-headed mountains. When they gather together again, they are inserted into a great iron machine and pressed like sugarcane. Then they reassemble on an iron surface where great iron boulders are hurled upon them, cutting, splitting, smashing, and flattening them, again causing torrents of blood to gush forth. In the howling hell, living beings who search for a home are herded into an iron house and incinerated by blazing fire and conflagration. The great howling hell is similar to this, except the beings are inside two iron houses, one within the other. And the thing about the hells, of course, is when you're exterminated, you come back again and it starts all over again. The same sort of process goes on and on. So those are the hot hells. So we can just, it's recommended that we, instead of, you know, generating ourselves as a deity when we're doing esoteric tantra practice, it's also good to generate ourselves in the aspect of the hell being, what it would be like for us to be there, experiencing that suffering, purely as a result of the negative karmas we have done and have been unable to purify. So then, there is also the realm of hungry ghosts. So here the suffering seems to be especially hunger and thirst, and supposed to be through a lack of generosity, being very miserly, is one reason why you can be born here. So we can either think of ourselves as being hungry ghosts, or, you know, you can think of yourself as being human, experiencing some of these sufferings of hunger, thirst. It's very easy. Many people experiencing similar sufferings, a human form. But the hungry ghosts, those who have external obstacles, when these hungry ghosts approach springs, lakes, and ponds, beings holding swords, long spears, and short spears block their way, or else the water appears to them as pus and blood, and they lose their desire to drink. Beings who have internal obstacles. These beings have goiters and great bellies, but their mouths, which spew flames, are as small as the eye of a needle. Though others do not prevent them, they are unable to ingest food and drink, even when they obtain it. So, hungry ghosts with other obstacles. Some of these hungry ghosts, unable to make use of clean and wholesome food, drink, wholesome food and drink, cut their own flesh and eat it. those called possessing a garden of flames are burned, because whatever they attempt to eat or drink bursts into flames. Those called filth eaters can only ingest dirty, stinging, harmful, and despicable things, and so they eat feces and drink urine. Many times in our wandering in samsara, we've been born as an animal. The third of the three lower realms, more obvious to our sight, no description of that in that section of the great treatise. But we can just imagine what it would be like to be born. You know, imagine being one of those donkeys in India that are carrying heavy loads of bricks with sores all over the back, or, you know, little bird that has to make this perilous migration early in the spring when the weather can still be very bad, but somehow the urge to set off seems to be the right time. So they're risking everything on perilous crossings of great oceans, or some birds even cross the Sahara Desert, don't they? The swallows from coming north from their wintering grounds. Those vulnerable small creatures engaged on these sort of epic journeys, or, you know, struggles to find food, or being exploited by humans totally indifferent to their suffering in battery farms or other forms of, you know, terrorization. So what conclusion do we draw from these meditations? Well, we are the words the text use are things like disenchantment with cyclic existence, or revulsion from cyclic existence, despairing of and renouncing the world. Turning away from worldly indulgences when they're only going to lead to this. In particular, from the last meditations we've been doing, negative actions, it's negative karmas, actions which harm others that are, immediately responsible for our rebirth in the lower realms. So whether those negative actions come from, they come from, privileging the self, self-cherishing, you do the negative action thinking it will benefit you, prepared to let others suffer, imposing harm on others, taking advantage of them for your own benefit. So that seems to be what a negative action is. So the verse from the Awakening Mind, verses from Lama Chöpa, self-cherishing, this obstinate disease, is cause of all unwanted suffering. Seeing this, resent it fiercely. It's to blame. Bless me to crush this gross fiend, selfishness. So if we can't put our finger on the absolute, deep cause, ultimate cause of cyclic existence just yet, at least we can, relieve some of the, danger we're in by abandoning, rejecting temptation of selfishness, self-cherishing. So let's just dedicate the merits then now from that meditation. May all the positive effort we put in, and the sort of good results maybe that we've created, may it all go towards being completely free from cyclic existence, being no longer addicted, being no longer bewildered by its trickery. It appears in one way, but its true nature is another. And then, with the wisdom, with the insight we gain, coupled with compassion, to go to the highest stage of evolution, completely beyond those dangers, for the benefit of all, so that we can be of use to show other people the way too. Thank you very much.
Like this. I had it in my hand and then
So it's all suffering then, is it? Even that toast and marmalade you had for breakfast. Yeah. We need one of those. Another one there. Well, when you look at what's the definition of truth of suffering? That which arises from its cause, the truth of origins, and is included within cyclic existence. And then when you give the example of that, they say, so it's like the beings within and the container that contains them. So that's the world that we live in and the beings there. So they're all, you know, kind of included in the truth of suffering. So I guess that includes the toast and marmalade. Is toast and marmalade, does that arise from its cause? Affliction and karma? Well, didn't the baker who made the bread, someone like me, for instance, don't say direct cause, but there's lots of indirect causes. So as part of the, you know, the causal collection that produced the bread and the marmalade, you can posit there is affliction there. Because the baker, he may be making it, he's not thinking, he may not be thinking, oh, I'll make lots of money. He may not be thinking, oh, I'll use cheap flour. He may not be trying to cheat people or do anything really negative. But he's still being a person who's bound in psychic existence and doesn't really even understand the law of karma very well. You know, anyway, he's got the self-grasping at the root of it, you know. So I think they'd say that's, you know, his actions are, to some extent, motivated by affliction. So then the bread is the result of his actions. So. Yeah, I think the thing we say the bread and the marmalade would be true suffering. The truth of suffering. So the truth of suffering sets its net quite wide, doesn't it? It embraces, the whole of cyclic existence really is the truth of suffering, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. Don't say they're permanent. Yeah, well, they can't be both impermanent and permanent.
No,
so,
I mean, as a label, if you were taking them as a form of marmalade bread, so it surely doesn't have any inherency in existing bread and marmalade. So, in which case, it's permanent because it's being repeated and then having
Well, I think it's good to separate out the concept of bread from bread, yeah? The concept of bread is something we have in our heads, yeah? So I'm thinking this is a book. So I have a concept, a book. That's like an idea of book, a thought, book. And that's the book, yeah? So let's separate those. So that's a thing that's made of matter. and your concept is something that's made of consciousness. That's a moment, a passing moment in your consciousness. So you're thinking about the book. So here's the concept, or here in the mind or something, whatever the mind is, and that's the book. So don't get them mixed up. But even the concept of book is just a passing thing. That's just an impermanent thing, for that matter. And the label, you know, the label book. A label in Tibetan is usually thought of as sound, yeah? The name book, the sound book, that's the label. You can write that down and say then it's on paper, but that's just a representation of the sound, you see. So that's how they look at the letters on the page. They're just an abstract way of representing the sound. So all of those are actually impermanent. But the bread and marmalade, yeah, that's, or the bread, the toast and marmalade, impermanent, arising from causes and conditions. A result of affliction and karma. So, you know, the outer world and the inner world of the being, the person, they're all, you know, take shape through, you know, contaminated karma we're talking about here. Of course, you can have pure karma if you meditate on emptiness directly, you know, in your sort of superior being level state. That's still karma, isn't it? It's still action. But that's uncontaminated karma, you see. So that's there's no delusion left in the mind at all. You're just completely kind of connecting with emptiness. So that's going to ripen up as something, you know, like as getting you out of samsara. But the contaminated karma, even if it's not particularly negative, of the baker making his bread in the morning, contaminated karma, some delusion is in the cause or collection. You know, so the effect of that, of an action that is, you know, defiled or like somehow contaminated like that, is just a ripen up in cyclic existence as something which isn't, you know, it's going to have its limitations. It's going to decay, or it's going to, you know, nourish you, but only for a short time, and that kind of thing. Yeah, I mean, you look at it whether it's contaminated or not. Here we're talking about contaminated karma, because the karma which produced it is like the ordinary contaminated karma we're all familiar with. So, yeah, so the point is then that it's arisen from its cause, contaminated karma and affliction. So therefore, it's true to say it's the truth of suffering, according to the definition which you know, is provided. And that when you divide truth of suffering, there's two. There's the inner beings and the outer world. So, you know, it's quite clear that truth of suffering also applies to the objects. So to what extent then, you know, then they start talking about, oh yeah, so when you see a contaminated object, it gives rise to, you know, there's a danger it will give rise to in the person who's not, you know, a complete practitioner. It gives rise to further attachment, further afflictive minds, further desire or attachment or anger or something. The sort of dodgy phenomena of this world are very good at leading us, you know, as prompting, stimulating us to develop more, you know, disturbing emotions. So it's kind of our fault, but that's the kind of object it is. It will do that. If you see the body of a Buddha clearly, so it wouldn't do that to you. You know, it's just a different type of object. Anyway, better have some tea. We've run over time already. Let's have a little break. But your questions are very welcome. Yes, please. Just tea with milk, no sugar, plain tea. Milk tea, yeah, plain.
No sugar.
No sugar.